discussions around how we should build AI that don't account for what we're trying to build are essentially pointless, right? There is no right way to build AI. An anomaly arises because what we have is we're still in the mindset where, like, okay, the goal is to build, to like recreate a human. But suddenly we're like in the natural world. And then it's like, okay, so we want to recreate a human in the natural world, right? And then this suddenly starts to be a bit weird. People in machine learning and AI research, particularly people who've entered the field more recently, say things like, it's not clear what we have ever learned from the brain, right? From the study of it. So this is, you know, kind of in my view,
This is Brain Inspired.
Good day to you. I am Paul. My guest today is Christopher Summerfield. Chris runs the Human Information Processing Lab at University of Oxford, and he's also a research scientist at DeepMind. You may remember him from episode 95 with Sam Gershman when we discussed ideas around the usefulness of neuroscience and psychology for artificial intelligence. Since then, he has released his book, Natural General Intelligence: How Understanding the Brain Can Help Us Build AI. And in the book, Chris makes the case that inspiration and communication between the cognitive sciences and AI is hindered by the different languages each field speaks. But in reality, there's always been, and still is, a lot of overlap and convergence about ideas of computation and intelligence. And he illustrates this using tons of historical and modern examples. So I was happy to invite him back on to talk about a handful of the topics in the book, although the book itself contains way more than we discuss. You can find a link to the book in the show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/159. Thanks for listening. Here's Chris. I was just looking it up, and it was actually almost a year ago today that we spoke last. You were on with Sam Gershman, and it was mid-January. So I was just looking it up because I was thinking, what episode was that? When was that? And since then, you have published this bright, shiny new book, Natural General Intelligence. And I was in the preface to the book, you write that it took you 10 months to write the book. And this is, there's so much in the book that's a blistering speed, it feels like, to write a book. But you also mentioned, hey, AI is, you know, increasing, advancing at a super rapid pace. And so, one, how did you write the book that fast? And two, how much worry did you have that it would be immediately outdated, essentially, the AI facts in it, right? So neuroscience, psychology, not advancing so fast. AI advancing very fast, so you didn't have to worry so much that you'd be outdated in your neuroscience, maybe.
Yeah. Thanks for those questions. Yeah, well, it didn't feel very fast when I was writing it, I can tell you. Maybe I don't know how long it takes people to write, but I think one of the reasons that I found it relatively easy to write, at least once I got going, was because some of the material is part of a course which I teach. So the sort of structure of the book and the kind of the conversations and the arguments and the things that I felt I needed to explain were sort of present, kind of in my mind. So yeah, that's one reason. And, you know, kind of also purely incidentally, you know, kind of, I just found that actually I really love writing. I think, you know, kind of probably much better at writing than I am at actually doing other aspects of science. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, I the synthetic process of, you know, kind of getting those ideas down and trying to make sense of them was personally like hugely enriching. I'm sure many other people have that experience too. In terms of the book being out of date, yeah. So obviously I would love people to read it.
It's not out of date, by the way.
I mean, you know, kind of, I would love people to read it, but the neuroscience, of course, is not out of date. And the neuroscience, you know, kind of, I still feel like neuroscientists are, to some extent, you know, this ideas come out in machine learning and AI research, and it takes a while for them to percolate through to the first, typically to the computational community, and then out into the sort of wider communities. And that process, you know, kind of some of the models and ideas which are described in the book will be, you know, kind of probably news to a lot of people working in mainstream neuroscience, and certainly to my kind of, you know, the audience that I had in mind while I was writing, which is sort of like undergraduates who are interested in cognition and computation in the brain. So that's definitely true. But in terms of AI research and, like, you know, kind of the sort of what's new, you know, sorry guys, but, you know, it was out of date. It was out of date 3 months after I submitted it. Dramatically so. I actually, you know, kind of OUP, you know, OUP are actually a little bit faster to turn around books than some other publishers. But even so, you know, kind of by the time it was due to go to production, which was, I think, in July 22, like 3 or 4 months after I submitted it, they said, well, hey, do you want to update it? Because has anything changed?
That's what I was going
to
ask.
Yeah. I need to rewrite the whole thing. Sorry.
No, but did you? Were you in your, at least in your mind, were you thinking, do I need to go and see if a new model has been released and update it? Or did you just say, screw it, I'm going to, this is what it is?
Well, I mean, the major thing. So obviously GPT-3 was out while I was writing the book, and as was the initial DeepMind's initial model. So Gopher, their language model, was released while I was still writing the book. But both were, well, the language models, you know, between the time when I submitted and the time when it went to production, we went from basically having, like, you know, a couple of language models to having a whole explosion of and startups and so on. The other thing that changed dramatically was text to image generation. So when I was writing the book, there were a bunch of models. So there was the first version of DALL-E, and then there was Glide, which was this sort of, I can't remember.
I can't keep up.
I can't remember if that was Brain. No, I can't. I probably should know this, but I can't. Anyway, these early models, which, you know, everyone was like, wow, that's incredible. But then compared to what came later, to what, you know, DALL-E 2 in particular, and then and now we have, you know, all those, they were, you know, they were a bit rubbish by comparison. So, you know, kind of, I had to go in and update all the figures in the book, because I'd had these figures of, like, look what you can do with text to image generation. And, you know, if they now what we can do is much better.
So, yeah. It's almost like we need to change the format, and books need to be digital, where you can just plug in the latest creation, right? Figure 10.2, and it just refreshes every month or something.
Well, yeah, like in Harry
something.
Where the, like in Harry Potter, the news is is animated. Yeah, I guess that would be great.
Yeah. So, okay, so I didn't read the subtitle of the book. The title is Natural General Intelligence, and the subtitle is How Understanding the Brain Can Help Us Build AI. And throughout the book, you talk about the all of the principles in AI that can be kind of mapped onto some of the things that we have learned throughout the years in neuroscience. But of course, in, like, the industry world in AI, a lot of people are fond of bragging that we don't need to pay attention to any natural intelligence. And look, we did this on our own, and you're actually learning from us. So sometimes it was the wording in the book was, you know, I think you used the word inspired a few times, and sort of mapped them together. But it wasn't clear always, like, whether that the artificial intelligence advances were, you know, how much attention they were actually paying to the natural intelligence research, right? So I don't know if you just want to comment on that, but because there are so many different, like, when you put them all together, there are so many different ways in which they kind of can map onto each other. But is it, I had the sense that AI world really was proud about not having paid attention to NI world, natural intelligence world. Do you think that's the case? Or do you think that, I know in your world, in like the DeepMind world and in your neuro AI kind of world, that is a celebrated aspect. But in AI world writ large, do you think that people feel the same?
Yeah, there's so much to say here. Let me see if I can order my thoughts and try and answer the question by parts.
Obviously, mine aren't. Yeah.
So the first thing to say is let me answer a question which you didn't ask, which is about the converse direction, right? So has AI been useful for neuroscience? Unequivocally, yes, right? So, you know, kind of our field, over the past few years has been dramatically invigorated by this kind of, you know, what people call like neuro AI, or I don't know, they have different terms for it. But yeah, the advent of, you know, connectionist models in the form of, you know, deep learning architectures, recurrent architectures, increasingly deep RL, you know, kind of like all of these ideas percolating into neuroscience has been great for the field. And it's, you know, it's sparked some interesting debates around, you know, kind of what are we trying to do in computation? You know, do we care about, how much do we care about interpretability versus predictive validity for our models? You know, kind of what is an, you know, what is an explanation of a neural system if it has 100 million parameters? Those kinds of questions, which have been very rich, and I think good for the field to have those debates. And, you know, kind of just computational ideas flowing into neuroscience. And that's great. And we can talk more about that. But let me try and answer the question that you did ask. So you asked about what people in machine learning and AI research think about the role of neuroscience or cognitive science and its relevance for their research. So there are many, many answers to this question because there are many diverse viewpoints. Let me try and answer the first, tackle one of them. And this is something that I hear quite often. So sometimes people in machine learning and AI research, particularly people who've entered the field more recently, say things like, it's not clear what we have ever learned from the brain, right, from the study of it. So this is, you know, kind of in my view, this is this is an opinion which does not adequately reflect the influence that neuroscience has had on AI historically. Right. So historically, you know, from the very first symbolic AI models, right, which maybe today are, you know, somewhat out of fashion, but, you know, kind of the fields of psychology and then later cognitive science and neuroscience and AI research have been like, you know, kind of intricately intertwined in their goals, you know, to sort of understand thinking and build a thinking machine. And then as we move into the era of connectionist models and then deep learning, you know, obviously the structure of these models is inspired by neuroscience in the sense that, you know, kind of network, they involve information processing in networks of neurons, albeit simplified networks of neurons, which obey many of the principles that we've learned about from neuroscience. And the people who built the first successful models were either trained in psychology or neuroscience or explicitly, you know, kind of have articulated how those ideas inspired them. And that continues to some extent up to the present day. So, you know, if you think about the latest architectures, you know, kind of LSTM models, recurrent neural networks and LSTM models, you know, obviously have a very clear biological correlate or biological, I mean, I don't know if the, I don't know if Jürgen Habermas would say that, sorry, Schmidhuber. Habermas is a philosopher. He didn't build any neural networks as far as I know. But
you better get it right with Schmidhuber too, because he'll let you know, right, if you don't.
The comparison to Habermas is flattering, I think. But anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if Schmidhuber would say that he was inspired by neuroscience, but it's clear that those, you know, kind of there is an analogous current of thought in psychology and neuroscience about how working memory happens, which is really, you know, really important. And then if you think about, you know, even up to the current day, right, think about meta learning, a really powerful approach, you know, kind of directly inspired by ideas about prefrontal cortex and basal ganglia in a paper whose first and senior author were both neuroscientists. You know, I think that historical trend is there and it continues to this day. Now, that doesn't mean that people in machine learning and AI research always appreciate that.
There are so many different things. I mean, like, I wanted to jump in when you said LSTM, because you tell the story about the mapping of LSTMs with the basal ganglia and the gating function account of basal ganglia. And actually, I don't know that I had even appreciated that connection. I mean, I know that LSTMs, of course, anytime you have a new model in AI, the neuroscience world kind of grabs it and says, maybe this is a model for how the cortical column works, which has been done with the LSTM also. But so I have, like, you know, tons of notes from your book, and we could talk, and we will talk about tons of topics. But to get us into that, I'm kind of wondering,
you know, along the process of you writing it, even though you wrote it at such breakneck speed, did you change your mind about anything, or did you come to appreciate anything, you know, that stands out in your mind that you maybe you thought this way, and then, well, that's what changing your mind is. You thought this way about something, and then as you wrote about it and clarified your thoughts and learned more information, you learned that maybe you should think about it a different way, et cetera.
Yeah, I think probably not globally. I think, you know, kind of really, but I think, you know, the book does not, I didn't set out to kind of really espouse one viewpoint or opinion, right? A lot of science books, including the ones, you know, many that I know and love, you know, what they do is they use a particular viewpoint as a way in to expose some problem. And, you know, they make the book compelling through, you know, how compelling their argument is in favor of this view, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I could give you many examples. I didn't set out to do that, right? I wanted to give something which was a bit more balanced, and I wanted to give voice, you know, in debates around like, how should we build AI, right? Like these perennial questions of like, you know, what are the constraints that we need? Do we need really explicit constraints? Like some people have argued, you know, for like symbolic style or varial binding style, variable binding style constraints. I tried to give voice to like both sides of the argument, and often to try and point out where I thought maybe they were sort of missing each other, missing the point that each other was making. And, you know, kind of, I often feel that my viewpoint, maybe, you know, kind of, this is just me, but I often feel that my viewpoint isn't sort of like, oh, you know, kind of where there's two kind of different camps. It's like, oh, I'm strongly aligned to A or I'm strongly aligned to B. My viewpoint usually tends to be, you know, when someone from A is evaluating ideas from camp B, this is where they miss the point and vice versa. Right. And, you know, my view is often about where two opposing positions converge or diverge, rather than, you know, necessarily strongly espousing one or the other.
Is part of that talking past each other? How much of it is talking past each other, and how much of it is a true, staunch divide?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of talking past each other, and there's a lot of semantics involved, right? I mean, in the debate, you know, in the later chapters of the book, I make reference to a very, very long-standing debate, which relates to, you know, the question of, as I mentioned, the question of whether we need constraints on our models, which are quite explicit. So, you know, kind of cognitive scientists throughout the past 20 years, I mean, of course, before as well, but especially throughout the past 20 years, have, you know, taken issue with the undifferentiated nature of the information processing in connectionist or deep learning models. And they've said we need things like explicit constraints. Those might be, you know, kind of, they might be mechanisms which, you know, kind of deliberately discretize information in ways that make it amenable to like composition, or, you know, kind of the sorts of discrete or rule-based processing that we have traditionally thought of as part of what humans do. And, you know, kind of those people have very often kind of advocated for those types of constraints without asking the question of whether they implicitly emerge out of the types of architectures that we build anyway, right? So, you know, kind of it's clear that neural networks can learn to perform, you know, various classes of rule-based inference. And actually they can do so in highly structured ways under the right constraints and with the right inductive biases. And, you know, kind of very often people from the symbolic camp have sort of said, you know, rather than saying, oh, well, actually that validates my point that, you know, kind of this form of computation is important, right? Instead, they've tried to focus on, you know, identifying corner cases where neural networks fail and saying, well, you know, kind of you haven't done it right. And, you know, I think that's made the debate a little sterile. On the other side of the argument, you know, kind of there's a sort of unpleasant kind of bradagio in amongst machine learning researchers that is like, you know, kind of a sort of muscular tendency to assert superiority because their models are, you know, kind of they're more effective in an engineering sense, right? Because they actually do stuff. And you know, to be really dismissive of ideas from cognitive science. And you know, I think that's also equally unhelpful, because you know, as Jan LeCun, who's, you know, someone who's advocated for, of course, the deep learning approach, you know, he's been not only one of the founders of that movement, but also kind of a spokesperson for that opinion. You know, as he says, what does he say? Oh, no, I've lost my train of thought.
Oh,
it's terrible.
He says more than a few things.
Well, he says more than a few things. I can't remember which one.
Is this pertaining to the nativist empiricist divide, the symbolic versus?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, as he says, like, you know, kind of machine learning researchers are in the very business of building inductive biases into their model, right?
Right.
You know, kind of those cognitive scientists who've argued for a kind of a nativist, what's been billed as like a nativist approach, right? That we need to build in these constraints. You know, what LeCun has said is, well, you know, kind of machine learning advances through innovation on those very inductive biases, right? And you know, that's literally, if you're a machine learning researcher, that's literally your day job, is to find those inductive biases. And I just think that's true, right? I mean, the conversation has become, I think, you know, kind of circular and a little boring sometimes.
But so you see, I mean, you point to inductive biases and talk about them at some length as, you know, this middle ground, right? That the symbolic AI folks should acknowledge that there is built-in structure, the nativists, right? That there is built-in structure, that it's not just one big undifferentiated neural network. And on the other hand, I suppose the connectionists, which, you know, as you say, Jan LeCun, who was, you know, one of the first people off of Fukushima's neocognitron to start building that structure into the earliest convolutional neural networks, that there should be an acknowledgement that, yeah, we and maybe there is already an acknowledgement, as you were saying, that the inductive biases are necessary to advance.
Yeah, exactly. And I think often the, you know, and this is a point that I really tried to make in the book, you know, kind of discussions around how we should build AI that don't account for what we're trying to build are essentially pointless, right? There is no right way to build AI. What there is there are solutions to particular problems. And, you know, very often when people disagree, they're not actually disagreeing about the pathway to building the technology. What they're disagreeing about is what the problem is in the first place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we talk about inductive biases, you know, clearly debates about the extent to which we should handcraft in particular constraints or inductive biases, those are theories, not just of like what will work, right? They are theories of what will work in the context of a particular environment that you have in mind, right? Of course, you need to tailor the degree of constraint in your model to the open-endedness or diversity of the data that you want it to be able to process, right? So, you know, if you only ever want the network to do one thing, then of course you should tailor it to do that one thing. It would be silly not to, right? If you want it to do lots and lots of things, then it needs to be very general. And the question is, how general is the natural world? You know, if you imagine that what we want is to build something that, you know, kind of behaves in the natural world, how general is the natural world? Well, of course, the natural world is, you know, infinitely rich and complex, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't have constraints too. And when we look at the inductive biases that have been successful, they tend to reflect properties of the natural world. So, you know, in the natural world, I don't know, like time goes forward. So it's pretty useful to have a memory system, because that means that your behavior can be conditioned not only on the now, but also on the past, right? And the relevance of information in the past may not be like uniform across time, right? Things that happen recently tend to be more relevant than things that happen a long, long time ago. And there is a function that describes that relevance. And it's not necessarily, you know, kind of completely linear as well. And that means that, you know, we need not just one memory system, but multiple memory systems, right? We have memory systems which deal with the immediate past and memory systems that deal with the longer term. And that's reflected in the types of, it's reflected in our sort of psychology 101, like memory is modular, but it's also reflected in the structure of the inductive biases that we build into our models. And LSTM is a great example, right? You know, what it does is it says, well, you know, actually we need to maintain information over two timescales in memory. One which is sort of ongoing and active, and one which can be placed into a kind of pending state and then released when needed. And that turned out to be a really good solution, probably because it matches a property of the world, right? That some information, you know, you need to place in the pending state and then be able to use it when it comes up, which is very useful if you want to not lose your train of thought, for example.
Well, speaking of losing one's train of thought, I mean, I was going to ask you about this later, but I'll just bring it up now because you were talking about the properties of the natural world. And this comes toward the end of your book when you're talking about artificial general intelligence. And you a moment ago were mentioning about what you build depends on the problem that you want to solve. And I mean, you talk about Umwelts in the book, which is the term given to, you know, the relationship essentially between an organism or an agent, I suppose, an artificial agent, and it's the environment that it's dealing with, its capabilities within that environment. And its perceptual world is built around its scale, its needs, its desires. You know, an ant has a very different Umwelt than we do. And in, you know, not the same breath, but you also talk about affordances, which is that relationship based on like what we can do based on the properties of the natural world. You know, we, you know, can reach for an apple based on our abilities and the accessibility of the apple and our abilities to eat it and consume it and so on. And I've just been pondering the usefulness of creating artificial intelligence in the guise of humans, and whether an AGI or any AI could ever have be exposed to the same things that we're exposed to, right? Because you also talk about homeostatic needs. Why would we want an AI to ever have homeostatic needs? And homeostatic needs shape the problem. Okay, this is always coming back to the problem that we're solving, which is staying alive, reproducing, right? The problems that we're solving, why would we want to build anything to solve those same problems? To essentially have the same structure and relationship with the natural world. I'm sorry, that was a long-winded commentary and question.
It's clear. I mean, yeah, it's a great question. I mean, you know, kind of at the root is the question of like, you know, kind of what do we want to build and why? And the answers to that have changed, and they've changed in a way which reflects our different theories of cognition and our different understanding of biology. So, you know, kind of when people set out to build AI in the first place, you know, kind of the goals that they set themselves were very, very divorced from like the everyday structure of the environment, right? So, you know, kind of if you think of the initial reasoning systems, you know, kind of whether it was like, you know, kind of systems for proving theorems, through pure logic, or systems for, you know, kind of playing games like chess or whatever. These are pursuits which are kind of very divorced from, you know, the kind of our quotidian embedding in the natural world with, you know, kind of that's characterized by bodily movements and, you know, interactions with social others and so on, right? And so naturally, you know, it was quite easy to have a paradigm that says, okay, well, humans can do X, so let's try and build something that does X, right? And that was the initial paradigm. And that paradigm kind of continued on into, you know, kind of the deep learning era, in which suddenly we have models which are grounded in much more naturalistic settings. And here, an anomaly arises, because what we have is we're still in the mindset where like, okay, the goal is to build to like recreate a human. But suddenly we're like in the natural world. And then it's like, okay, so we want to recreate a human in the natural world, right? And then this suddenly starts to be a bit weird, right? Because it's like, why would we want to do that? Like already, you know, there are 8 billion people on the planet.
Right.
You know,
kind
of, if you want to create humans, it's actually not that hard to create new humans. Although, you know, it does take two of you and a little bit of time.
It's sometimes it's hard. But, yeah. But yeah, I get what you're saying. Yes.
Yeah. So you're absolutely right to point that out. Yeah. So it's not always simple or straightforward for everyone. But in general, on average, we, you know, as a population, we have been able to, you know, kind of to populate the planet without recourse to AI. So yeah, I mean, the question is where do we sit now, right? And how do we reconcile this idea of like that the goal of AI building is somehow agenthood,
mm-hmm.
like the recreation of human agenthood, with the kind of much more general problem of like, what would we actually do with the system if we got it, right? And it becomes relevant because as we realize more and more that our intelligence is, human intelligence is grounded in those very facets of our behavior, which are like kind of not really, you know, the slightly esoteric, you know, kind of ability to reason about abstract problems or whatever, but are also grounded in, you know, things like how we interact with each other socially, or even grounded in like, you know, movements of our body, right? You know, object recognition is part of object recognition is not just being able to attach a label to something, but being able to pick it up, right? And when we take that on board, then suddenly we ask ourselves the question, well, if we built these systems, would they actually have the same bodies as us? Well, maybe, but maybe not. And then you ask, well, would they have the same like social life as us? And then you're like suddenly into super weird territory.
Mm.
So, you know, almost certainly not, right? You, I mean, unless we get into sort of weird science fiction territory.
Yeah, no, it would, I mean,
right.
I don't know, you know, self-organizing systems, et cetera, always come back, you know, to this, well, let's say an attractor state or something, but I just can't imagine that trying to emulate humans in building an AI, the affordances, the Umwelt, the problems to solve, the whole collection of problems to solve is going to be so different that it has to be a very different kind of intelligence.
Right. So that's the argument, right? So if you cut out those things, if our intelligence depends upon, you know, how we interact with the world physically and socially, and we a priori just, you know, kind of don't want to build an agent that would share those properties, then it means that its intelligence will be different from ours, you know, in the same way that, you know, kind of, I love, there's a book by, a primatologist called Franz de Waal, very well-known primatologist, called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are?
Mm-hmm.
It's a well-known, very successful popular science book. I love that book. And, you know, basically it's a sort of, it's a story of anecdotes from across his career and, you know, really good experimental research as well, which shows that broadly, you know, animals are incredibly smart, but they're just not smart on our terms, right? And we deem them as being less smart than us because they're not smart in the way that we are smart, right? And I think when we evaluate the intelligence of AI, it's often exactly the same thing. You know, we sort of say, oh, well, this agent isn't smart because it doesn't understand this thing that we humans understand. And, you know, kind of, well, often there's no reason why it should, right? Because, you know, it doesn't go to the opera or, you know, didn't go to dinner parties or do whatever humans do, you know, kind of many, many other ways of interacting with each other, of course. But yeah, you know, and so we wouldn't expect it to share our intelligence. So the paradigm's changing. It has changed. And people are realizing that now, I think.
Maybe before, well, yeah, sorry, I'm just jumping around, but I'm just taking cues off of what you're talking about to talk about more things that you discuss in the book. And one is the concept of intelligence. And we were just talking about how we have a very particular kind of intelligence and we define all other animals and AI agents based on our notion of intelligence, but our notion of intelligence has changed. The focus of what we have considered intelligent behavior and thought has changed over the years. And I don't know if you want to just kind of step through a few of the ways that it's changed, but and or just acknowledge that it's an ongoing process.
Yeah, I think maybe there's one thing to say. So, you know, kind of I worried a lot about what to call the book. And I wanted to call it Natural General Intelligence by analogy with artificial general intelligence, obviously. But there was something that really put me off the title, and that was the word intelligence itself, because that word has a really bad rep, and with reason, right? And that's because, you know, kind of the whole notion that, you know, intelligence is this sort of, you know, this essence of individuals that we can use to kind of, that we can quantify and we can use to categorize people as maybe having more of it or less of it and so on, you know, has rightly, you know, kind of been viewed as like, you know, kind of elitist and discriminatory. And more than just being viewed as that, you know, kind of intelligence testing, the psychometric measurement of intelligence has, not so much latterly, but certainly throughout the 20th century, has been used to basically, you know, kind of reinforce cultural stereotypes. And worse, right? You know, some of the earliest uses of intelligence testing were related to, you know, eugenic theories about who should and should not be allowed to reproduce, right?
So, those were bad?
You know,
wait,
kind of,
hang on.
Yeah. So, you know, rightly, you know, the word intelligence, I think, turns people off. And, you know, kind of, I do try to highlight that in my book. And I highlight it a little bit sort of by analogy, but with the point that I made about our failure to understand animal intelligence, right? That from the perspective of the sort of, you know, the Western ivory tower in the developed world, you know, kind of very often it is an utter failure to understand the situatedness of intelligence in other cultures or other modes of behavior that has led to, you know, kind of discrimination and bias in the way that we think about other people, right? And that you can see that in the history of intelligence testing. Which is a pretty, you know, dismal, it's a pretty dismal history in some ways. I mean, I'm sure that there is, we have learned things about, you know, kind of the structure of cognitive ability, and I wouldn't want to take away from those who work in that area, but I'm sure everyone who's working in that area today would acknowledge that it has a darker side. And I think it is the reflection of exactly the same point that I was making about, you know, kind of our failure to appreciate animals' abilities.
First of all, maybe there should be a caveat when defining intelligence. And you talk about the common Legg and Hutter definition. They collected 50 or so different definitions of intelligence and kind of whittled it down to a very small ability to adapt in new environments, I believe, something. I'm paraphrasing. But maybe the little footnote should be, given the particular set of problems of the agent or organism, you know, because it really does depend on the problem state, the set.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think AI research has, you know, kind of, as I said, maybe this is an unfair and sweeping generalization, but coming from cognitive science, but spending time with machine learning and AI researchers, I often feel that, you know, kind of, in machine learning and AI research, they're much better at the solution than they are at the problem, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, kind of, people are really good at, like, you know, kind of finding inventive solutions to particular problems, right? But they're much less good at thinking about what the relevance of that particular problem is in the first place. You know, the whole field is structured around benchmark tests, right? But nobody really asks where these benchmark tests come from or what they mean. I mean, people do. But, you know, kind of, it's not the sort of day-to-day topic of conversation. Whereas in cognitive science, you could almost make the opposite, right? People spend so much time worrying about the problem that they don't actually build models that are any good, which, of course, is another untrue sweeping generalization. But, you know, if you wanted to characterize the model continuum, you know, that would be one way of thinking about, you know, kind of what the difference between them.
We'll get into talking about, like, the current state of reinforcement learning models later, but... there's a large push these days in reinforcement learning for agents, and you talk about this in the book, to use more ecologically valid tasks, right? So there's a lot of game playing in like navigational maze type spaces and playing multiplayer games. What do you see as the current state of that? I mean, is that close enough to ecological validity? Are we still super far away? And again, with the caveat that it depends on what we're trying to do, right? But assuming we're trying to build like some human-like agents or something.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot to say here. So reinforcement learning has been one of the dominant paradigms within machine learning and AI research for 40 years now or something like that. And, you know, it kind of grew out of the methods in RL grew out of an approach which was to try and solve control problems, essentially, right? These are problems in which there's a relatively clearly defined objective. And what's difficult is to work out how to get there, right? And what RL does is it uses various methods, you know, some of them based on sort of, you know, kind of learning, you know, kind of stored values for states or actions, and some of them based on, you know, sort of explicit search methods. But it uses a variety of approaches to try to satisfy a well-defined objective. So that's why RL lends itself so nicely to things like playing Go, right? Because there's a well-defined objective, like, you know, well, I mean, we can talk about what the objectives might be. There are many objectives, actually, when we play games. Yeah. But it's easy to make the assumption that the objective is just to win. And if you make that assumption, then RL is wonderful, right? And so, you know, kind of in video games, we also have a clearly defined objective. Most of them have a score, and you keep on going. You're trying to maximize your score, and then you get on the leaderboard. And if you die, then it's game over, and you know you've got to start again. So it's very clear. But life is just not like that, right? So there isn't in life. Nobody says, you know, kind of this was your score for today, right?
Sometimes, but yeah.
Well, do they? I mean, not in general.
Yeah,
you know, you might get a score. You get a score for specific things, right? You know, maybe you're very happy because you did well on your exam, whatever. But like, you don't get a score for like, you know,
a daily score.
I don't know
score.
How nice you were.
Yeah.
How nice you were to your colleagues, or like, you know, kind of whether like you enjoyed the sunshine, or you know, kind of what you don't get a score for what life is really about, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the paradigm is hard to translate. It's really hard to translate. And yeah, there's no final point when you just win at life, right? It would be nice, but there isn't. So what actually happens in the real world? And this is a huge paradox, right? Because we have this paradigm, and RL, of all of the paradigms that we have in machine learning and AI research, RL is the one that's had the biggest impact on psychology and neuroscience, right? Because it grew up in this intertwined fashion with animal theories of animal learning. And we know that the neurophysiology of, you know, subcortical, to some extent, cortical systems is, you know, a really good match to what is actually implemented in successful algorithms, which have these optimality guarantees, which are, you know, really nice and whatever. So there's this beautiful, beautiful story. But at the same time, like the whole paradigm is just a convenient fiction, right? It's just not true. Like there are no, in RL, you know, RL is, it, when you build an RL model, what you're doing is you're working within a paradigm called a Markov decision process. And, you know, within that paradigm, you have these things called observations, which are like sensory data, and these things called rewards, which are what you're trying to ultimately maximize over, you know, some theoretical future discounted. And they're different things, right? But in the real world, this is just not true. You know, there is no difference between the taste of the apple and the reward of the apple, right? The reward of the apple is its taste, right? Or maybe it's the feeling of, you know, kind of the satisfaction that you have when you were, you know, you were hungry and you're less hungry anymore. But that itself also is a sensation, right? There are no rewards. There's just observations, right? So,
well, but
the RL paradigm is in the real world.
But the reinforcement learning world would want to map reward onto, let's say, relative level of dopamine, right? With unexpected value or something. And because that's the computational push to map it onto a tangible, effable value. But you're talking about qualia and the feelings. And so we don't have quantification of our feeling of awe yet, right?
It's not about qualia. It's not subjective. It's about the flow of information. In RL, rewards come from the world, right? The environment, it's like the researcher right. decides that apple is worth 10 points. And when you eat it, you get 10 reward points. When you have when there's an increase in your dopaminergic signal, that's not like the environment impinging directly on the brain to produce that signal. That signal is produced by the agent.
It's autonomy.
The agent that decides.
Yeah.
The agent decides what's good and what's not, right? But the reason why this is really difficult in the RL paradigm is that it leads to chaos. Because if I can just decide what's good and what's bad, and then I'm just like, well, I'm sorry, but I'm just going to decide that like sitting on the sofa and watching TV is like, you know, is good. And that's fine. And I'll just be happy forever until, you know, kind of I die of hunger and thirst or whatever, right? I don't mind because I'm having a great time sitting on the sofa. So it wouldn't, you know, but then, you know, that is the problem, is that in reinforcement learning, you know, kind of we often distinguish between like extrinsic and intrinsic rewards, right? And the salvation of the RL paradigm is that, you know, kind of in we can still think about rewards in the natural world, but those rewards must be intrinsic, which is that they must be generated by the agent, not by the world. And the question is, computationally, how did we evolve constraints that shape those intrinsic rewards so that our behavior is still adaptive, even though we are deciding what's valuable and what's not? And so, you know, kind of, I'm not saying that RL is wrong. It's just that the simple story about extrinsic rewards and that map onto the video game or the chess playing or Go playing example just doesn't work. You need a different paradigm.
But you don't think that to have an intrinsic reward, that an agent needs to be quote unquote truly autonomous, and then we get into the territory of, well, is that even possible if they're living in a simulation that we programmed through the computer that we built and programmed?
Yeah, well, this is the difficulty, right? Which is that, you know, kind of one of the reasons why it's nice to control the agent's behavior with extrinsic rewards is that the researcher has really tight control over the objectives, right? In theory, right? It's like you can say, you know, kind of this is what I want the agent to do, right? Within limits. I mean, the agents can still learn to do things that you weren't expecting. Right, that's, you know, you have these things called specification gaming or whatever. But if you let the agent make up its own reward function, then you're sort of in unknown territory, right?
How do you
the
do
agent
that?
Then is going to learn to do whatever, and then that's where you get into issues of safety and, you know, kind of because if the agent just, you know, if you build an intrinsic function, like you say, oh, I just want my agent to be curious. You know, if you have an extrinsic reward, which is like, you know, kind of please win this game or please eat lots of apples, then you can be pretty sure that the agent is going to do something like that, right? That doesn't mean there aren't safety concerns there, as, you know, many people have reminded us, but the safety concerns if the agent is making up its own value function are much more severe, or trying to satisfy something like let's just have control over the world, right? Then it's like, oh, okay, well, you know, there's lots of ways to have control over the world. Some of them might not be so good for people.
But okay, so this kind of harkens, and we'll go down the reinforcement learning path a little bit more here, and then we'll jump back out. You know, you mentioned the reward is enough hypothesis, which was a paper written a few years ago. I think the title was "Reward is Enough." Basically, you know, as a siren call that we really need for true AI, quote unquote, is reward. But then that gets in the definition of what a reward is. And you were saying there aren't rewards separate from objects. And then you can make the concept of reward so deflationary, right? So if you say instead of programming in reward, you give it some intrinsic reward by giving it curiosity, right? But then you can just call curiosity reward, and then the word reward becomes meaningless. So I don't know. What I guess I'm just asking for your comments on, you know, you argue against the idea that reward is enough, but you were just saying that to give an agent intrinsic reward, you know, it could go into chaos. But then I don't know what intrinsic reward is, if it's curiosity or if it's control, and or whether because you're still programming it to maximize something, there's still an objective function that you give it. So it's not its own objective function, right? The agent can't come up with its own objective function. Question mark.
Yeah. So clearly these issues are sometimes a bit hard to wrap your head around. Right? So I think that paper is actually making a claim which I don't agree with, but I think it's a slightly different claim from what it actually says in the title, right?
Of course.
The title maybe is a little bit of hyperbole. What the claim really is, I think, is that because of course you can define anything as a reward function, right? So you can say, okay, well, if it's intrinsic rewards, then, you know, kind of maximizing my knowledge or, you know, doing really good prediction in my generative model, right? These are my intrinsic objectives and their reward. I can write them down as reward and then I just maximize that and, you know, kind of everything. So the argument that there is a version of that claim which feels unfalsifiable, right? Mm-hmm. But I think what they're actually saying is that reward function, when you write it down, will be simple. That's the nature of the claim in that paper, is that it's simple enough that you could, as a researcher, as an AI researcher, you could write it down. There's some like magic formula which is sufficiently compact, right? That you write down, please, Mr. Agent, please, or Mrs. Agent, please, will you optimize this, 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 and this, right? And it's sufficiently simple that by just doing that, you get intelligent behavior. And you don't have to, this is an example I give in the book, like you don't have to then, you know, go through the world like the games designer of Atari games go through, like assigning rewards to particular states, like eating apples or whatever. You don't have to go through the natural world as an AI researcher and like, you know, assign 10 points for seeing a beautiful sunset and, you know, 30 points for, you know, I don't know, going to the football match or whatever. Because that would just, you know, because obviously nobody has time to do that, right? And actually it would take far more time to design a reward function in that way than it would just, you know,
do it.
Kind of to build a stupid app that does it.
Yeah.
So it's a claim, that paper makes a claim about the simplicity of the reward function, which I think, you know, is a defensible claim. And then, you know, the people who wrote that paper, very, very, very accomplished and, you know, researchers who've thought very deeply about this problem for many years, so it shouldn't be dismissed. I personally do not think that, I do not think that there is a simple extrinsic, a simple reward function of any form that could be written down, the maximization of which is just going to inevitably lead to intelligence.
Do you think that we are not algorithmic then in that sense that, you know, as we develop, right, our reward functions change, and as when we walk in a new room and there's a new problem to solve and there's only a screwdriver to solve it, you know, is it an algorithm that determines, hey, that's a metal screwdriver, so I can connect these two wires to turn the light on? Because the function of a screwdriver changes given. So I'm harking it back to now Stuart Kaufman's example of the next adjacent possible. I think it's called, where essentially the argument is that we're not algorithmic because in a given situation, everything that we've learned in the world, these static concepts through, you know, computational steps, you still wouldn't know how to use, a screwdriver could still be used for a new purpose in a different setting, right? And in that sense, it's fundamentally not algorithmic. And your objective function then has to change, essentially, to be able to use that screwdriver. I'm kind of mixing words here, but anyway, you know, are you suggesting then that we would not be able to write down one equation, however complicated it is, that would lead to intelligence via the reward is enough hypothesis?
I think I do agree that we can't do that, but I would maybe put it slightly differently. I mean, I'm not quite sure I understand what you mean by algorithmic, but maybe that's because I haven't read Stuart Kaufman. It sounds like I should, but. The you know, kind of, I think there's another way of putting my perspective, which is, you know, kind of in all of machine learning, we use an optimization paradigm, right? So there's some objective which is specified, right? And then the agent gradually converges towards that objective or not, right? You know, things go wrong, but, you know, kind of ideally they converge towards that objective. And then you know, kind of almost irrespective of which paradigm you're working in, there's an assumption that they do so in a general enough way through the heterogeneity of the training set, the diversity of their experience, that you can then, you know, kind of take them and you can plonk them in new and different environments, and they will, you know, kind of, they will behave with similar levels of performance, right? But, you know, kind of what this assumes is that the agent is somehow going to be able to sample, you know, kind of to take many samples from the training distribution and model the training distribution adequately, where the training distribution here corresponds to, you know, kind of the set of experiences which it would be possible to have, right? Mm. And I think that that's just not how it works in life, right? Because many, because we don't stick around for all that long, right? you know, we only get to have one life. And, you know, for most people, that life comprises only a tiny, tiny, tiny subset of the possible experiences that we could have, right? And so that whole sort of, you know, there's a global optimum for life and we're all just trying to optimize towards it. I think that paradigm is just not really applicable to the natural world. I think instead what happens is that we sort of make a lot of stuff up on the fly. So, you know, I really feel like what we do is we optimize very, very locally, like very, very locally, and in a really kind of like forgetful way a lot of the time, right?
I do,
you know,
yeah.
We get good. We get locally good at some stuff, and then, you know, we go off, we formulate some views or we learn some policies and we put them into practice, but then things change because the world is really open-ended, right? And
yeah,
we're not that good at dealing with change, right? We don't behave like an agent. You know, when I visit a new city, if I'm adept at behaving in that city, it's not because I have such a diverse set of experiences of all the possible things that a new city could throw up that I can just transfer zero shot. Rather, what happens is when I go to a new city, I use, like, I have a set of like reasonable but very, very blunt priors. And I sort of rapidly assemble them to kind of, you know, just about get by, probably misunderstanding a lot of stuff and probably, you know, being incredibly inefficient. And then, you know, then I go home and I probably forget most of it. And then I solve another problem. So the whole like optimization towards convergence paradigm, you know, I just don't think it works all that well in the natural world. Maybe you could think of it working for evolution, but for learning over the course of a single lifetime, a single individual, I just don't think it's all that useful.
You also, when you go to a new city and you haphazardly get by, you end up at a coffee shop, and whether it's, maybe it's okay. And then later you tell yourself, oh, I did that well, when it was perhaps, you know, we lie to ourselves. And you were kind of alluding to, I think it's Nick Chater's book that you talk about in your book about how, I don't, a flat mind, right? We have flat minds.
Flat, yeah.
The mind is flat, which is a section in your book. So I like that example. But you do, so a few times in the book, you talk about, you say, this is one of the biggest challenges in AI these days. And one of those is finding the right mix and match of reward functions. I don't know if you want to just say a few words about that, because given that we were talking about reward reinforcement learning.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think this is an interesting question, maybe not even for AI research, but it's an interesting question for neuroscience, right? Mm-hmm. Like to think about, you know, kind of RL clearly has given us a useful paradigm for thinking about learning, you know, even if the caveats that I just raised, you know, kind of apply. But I think it's useful to think about what should we actually optimize for, right? You know, kind of what are the objectives, you know, kind of in a world in which we
it's
make
to win
up.
To win, win, win. That's the objective.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, you think of the other thing about RL, let me say something else that I think is relevant, which is the other thing about RL is that, you know, that's a bit weird in the way it's typically implemented and used, is that rewards, when you get them, they're not fungible, right? So an asset which is fungible means that you can store it and disperse it at a later time, right? So like money, right? So I can put it in the bank and then spend it later. But that doesn't happen in like if you think of a deep RL agent playing Atari, right? It gets reward, but the reward just goes to its score, right? It's mm-hmm. the reward like augments its score and it like updates its value function and so on. But you can't like when I encounter assets in the natural world, then you know kind of typically an action which is available to me is to kind of store them in some way so I can use them. This happens even with like primary reinforcers, right? So if you think of what food does, right? Food isn't like something which is like instantly dispersed, ping, right? What it does is it, you know, improves your calorie, you know, it has calories which like, and it has nutrients which like, you know, kind of your body uses over various different timescales to support itself, right? So it's dispersed in that way. The same with, you know, kind of economic assets, right? They're used gradually over time. So, you know, kind of there's this notion that what actually matters in the world are there are inputs which change our bodily state in various ways. That's what I do when I'm eating an apple. I'm changing my bodily state. And you know, in RL, that's all in the world. And you could say, okay, yeah, because maybe that's a state which I can observe and so on. And you know, clearly everything, you can always shoehorn everything into an RL paradigm if you want to. But like, I think that the point here is that, you know, kind of we need to think more in neuroscience about what it means to learn those actions, to learn rewards for observations as a function of their consequence for our bodily state, right? And that then you suddenly get into all sorts of interesting territory, like, you know, kind of, you know, about mental health, you know, kind of, because of course, you know, sort of failures to appropriately learn intrinsic rewards for states, you can imagine that as being, you know, being tied to, you know, various kind of psych disorders, mm-hmm. maybe depression and its comorbidities. You know, we also need to learn things like intrinsically we need control, right? So control is very useful because it tells us that when we're being efficacious and when we're not, right? This is something really, really important. And, you know, similarly, we need to learn policies which exert the right level of control, right? And there's a lot of evidence that, you know, kind of having that control is something that really ties heavily into a sort of, you know, kind of healthy mood states and healthy psychology. Of course, if you seek to have too much control or too little control, then that can be tied to pathological states, right? So you know, kind of one way of thinking about, I'm not an expert in psychiatry or computational psychiatry, but you can see the connection to things like obsessive compulsive disorder, for example. So I think these things are really interesting and they're not very deeply explored from that computational perspective in psychology and neuroscience. And I think that's a big opportunity.
So that's what you mean by the right balance and mix of the right reward functions.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, to try and understand what people really want, right? Like, you know, kind of it's a silly question, but like, what do people want?
That's the problem, is we don't know, you know, we can't really define intelligence outside of our own problem space, and even individually our problem spaces are different, right? But and we can't say what we want, and what we want changes, what we claim to want anyway changes, and is that what we really want? Yeah,
well that's Nick Chater's point in The Mind is Flat book, right? Which is that we don't really have something. It's similar to my we don't really optimize point. And you know, disclosure, I'm hugely hugely influenced by reading Nick's work and also talking to him about it. You know, he's such an inspiration for me. But yeah, he says we don't really have a value function and we sort of make up what we want.
Isn't that pessimistic?
You know, it's not entirely true. Mm. Like, you know, we probably, you know, if you were water deprived for 2 days, you know, you probably really would want a glass of water. And, you know, people, you know, really do care about each other. You know, and there are things that we really, really do preferences that we really, really do have. But a lot of our preferences are just kind of arbitrary.
Yeah, especially if we're all satiated and, you know, happy and healthy. You can make up whatever preferences you want. Yeah, exactly. Nick Chater's...
But even in states of need, right? I mean, you know, people will go to extraordinary lengths, you know, kind of in people will go to, well, they will suffer extraordinary privation in pursuit of some like abstract ideal, which they've just kind of, well, I mean, you could say it's made up. I mean, you know, it's made up in a sense, right?
Well, we don't know, right? It's a problem with the ontology of the universe, I suppose. And I'm pushing us a little too far.
Those questions are above my pay grade. You need to get a philosopher on here to answer this. I'm sure many good.
Yeah. Well, no one. Yeah. Yes. And they all have the correct answer. All right. So I'm going to jump now again toward the end of your book when, you know, so before we were talking about reinforcement learning, we were talking about the nature of intelligence and the nature of the problems that we're solving. And I was questioning whether, you know, an AGI could ever have, you know, our intelligence because the nature of their problems are just going to be different. And why would you create another human? Number 8 billion, 7 million, blah, blah, blah. But you talk about the notion of going, you know, beyond our brains, right? Building intelligences that are superior to our brains, not human-like necessarily, not human level necessarily, but moving beyond. And whether that's wise, and you know, there's all sorts of ethical things that you touch on when you write about that as well. But I'd just like to ask you, like, for me, having read your book and thinking about these things, some of the things that I've been mentioning, that idea does not sound unappealing, nor does it sound impossible, given that we have our own faults and errors, and presumably we wouldn't need to build an AI system with those faults and errors. And even if it's an intelligence radically different than ours that we don't necessarily understand, if it's solving problems in a problem space that is not our human problem space, but is a problem space that we want to enter into, I don't see, except for the paperclip destroyer example, why we wouldn't do that, and why it wouldn't be possible.
Yeah. So I mean, there are many answers to this question. So the first one is that in narrow domains, of course, we have already built things that are better than humans.
Calculator.
Many ways, right? Yeah, my calculator is better at maths than me, at least at calculation. AlphaGo is better at Go than everyone. And, you know, my bet is that ChatGPT is probably more knowledgeable than any other that exists on the planet right now. That doesn't mean it's always right, as people have been, you know, obviously quick to point out, but it probably is on balance, like, better at answering general knowledge questions than any of the other 8 billion humans. I think that's probably a defensible claim. I might have to think about it a bit more.
Well, another point that you mentioned is that we always compare it to like the super expert in whatever domain we're talking about, right? So we would compare a language model to Hemingway or something like that, and not the average person. So,
yeah, no, for sure, for sure. So the question, you know, kind of we rapidly get entangled in questions of like, what do we want and what's right and so on. So there's many ways to answer this question. I mean, one is to counterpoint two different approaches, which I counterpoint in the book a little bit. And this is a sort of, you know, in the beginning, you asked me this question about, you know, kind of neuroscience and its role in AI. And there's another way in which psychology and neuroscience are relevant for AI research. And it's around the role, not of like theories of psychology, but the role of like human data and human data collection.
Okay.
And this is a counterpoint to, you know, we talked about like, you know, kind of how if you want to build something that plays Go or chess really well, then, you know, kind of you can use RL. It's a very clear problem. And actually, you know, what we learned in the process of solving Go, for example, was that you can do better if you stop using human data.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the RL is enough claim is also about that, right? It's sort of saying, like, you don't need to copy people. You just need to get the reward function right. And then everything else with enough computation and blah, blah, blah will take care of itself. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and that's exemplified by, you know, kind of the story of AlphaGo, which, you know, many people will be familiar with. But, you know, kind of basically, you know, AlphaGo originally was built by... You know, there was a lot of, it was bootstrapped off a lot of supervised training from human play, essentially.
Right.
And, you know, kind of lots of Go games scraped from the internet and, like, you know, kind of predictions about which moves were likely to lead to, which moves did lead to a win conditional on how the humans play. And then later the team, you know, kind of got rid of that, that human element and just built something that played with itself. And there it was able to do even better. Right. And that's the foundation for the story that, you know, kind of what we don't want humans in the loop at all. Right. But I think that the advent of language models, large generative models, and so on have really pushed our thinking back in the opposite direction. So it's back towards the idea that actually what we really do want is something that learns to be what humans want. So in other words, the ultimate reward function, it's not like you write down something clever, like, oh, be as curious as you can, or, you know, kind of be as powerful as you can, or whatever, and you just let it loose and it takes over the world. Actually, what you want is an agent which is exquisitely sensitive to social feedback. And lo and behold, just like we are, right? So, you know, kind of the really hard thing about being human is that, you know, it's difficult to know what other people want and what other people think, because it's not written on their faces, at least not, you know, very clearly. And so very often you say things that offend people, or that, you know, kind of that other people don't like, or you fail to anticipate their needs or their desires or their beliefs, and you get stuff wrong. And that's what makes it really hard to be a person, right? So we learn over the course of development to be really, really sensitive to social feedback from one another.
This seems somewhat related to inverse reinforcement learning. Stuart Russell's inverse reinforcement learning, where the idea is to learn the preferences of the human? That's kind of a related idea.
Well, it's related to value alignment in general.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So, you know, kind of the objective, I think we're increasingly realizing that the, you know, if we want AI that people will actually use and engage with in the way that, you know, kind of people really, you know, kind of engage with and are starting to use these language technologies for a range of different applications. If we want that, then, you know, kind of the signal that we really care about is the social feedback. And, you know, kind of that's not something which was a priori obvious, I think, you know, kind of throughout the history of AI research, deep learning research, in which it was always the researcher that set the objective, right? But, you know, we've been talking about throughout this conversation, we've been talking about how, you know, the natural world doesn't tell you, you know, what's good and what's bad and whether you've won. And that's true to some extent, but social others, right? Social others provide you with dense feedback, which is really, really important, and which we have learned to interpret in ways which, you know, are obviously hugely consequential for how we behave, right? And so, yeah. So this is what is happening, right? So, you know, the new method, which people call RLHF, reinforcement learning from human feedback, is like taking over. It's the, you know, learning to do this well is what everyone is, you know, kind of excited about right now, I think, because this is the answer to building models which are gonna like really be, you know, be preferred by people and be useful to people. Now, that doesn't mean you sidestep all of the thorny problems around value alignment or like fairness, for example, because, you know, as soon as you say, okay, well, we're going to, our agent is going to be trained to satisfy human preferences, it's like, well, whose preferences, right? So, you know, you don't want it to be, is it going to be the preferences only of like educated Western people? You know, how do we know that the preferences of like historically marginalized groups are properly weighted in this? What happens when people want different things, right? What happens when you have like majority-minority and dynamics and, you know, you have a dissenting views and, you know, who does the agent satisfy? So, you know, kind of this is, I think, where the action is right now. And so I don't talk about this really very much in the book, but this is actually the research that my group does at DeepMind.
Okay.
And so, you know, for many years we've worked on these problems of like value alignment, group alignment, preference aggregation. And, you know, I'm really gratified that now that we have good models, like in the wild, or, you know, kind of almost in the wild, that these issues are kind of coming to the fore. Because there are, you know, maybe you should think of another podcast, which is like, you know, kind of about the relationship between AI and social science, because, you know, kind of, I really feel that that is as exciting a frontier as the one, you know, the membrane between neuro and AI, which you've done so much to, you know, to highlight.
Oh, someone should do that podcast. I can't fit it, man. You said you didn't really talk about that much in the book. Another thing that you, so I'm aware of our time, and I have like this long list of questions. So I'm trying to like sort of prioritize what to ask you. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you, we started off talking about, you know, large language models and foundation models, which you allude to in the book a lot. But when it comes to like the transformers, and your book is, you know, largely all about comparing AI and neuro and inspiration back and forth and how we can use neuro for AI. But then you kind of have a one-off line where you say, well, it's really not clear yet how these awesome new models compare to the way that, to our psychology and our brains. And there have been a few studies comparing like fMRI and EEG, and that we are prediction machines just like the transformer models. And so it's kind of early days in that. But I wonder if you have more thoughts on that since publishing the book, or just, you know, if you think transformers are getting up further away from our brains, or if they're actually closer to our brains and psychology than we are appreciating at the moment.
Yeah. Great question. Thank you for asking that. So yeah, you're absolutely right. So people have done, you know, really nice work taking transformer models and comparing to the brain, sort of somewhat by analogy with the way that people sort of compared convolutional neural networks and the ventral stream system. And lo and behold, there are commonalities. And, you know, you might say, oh, that's expected because, you know, they're both predicting the same thing. So, you know, presumably it's the semantic information being predicted that is the root cause of the shared representation. So maybe it's not that surprising, but it's not to detract from the importance of that work. I think it's been a really nice brick in the wall. But you're asking a more, I think, a deeper question, which is like, why the hell are transformers so good? So nobody knows why transformers are so good, but they are so good. They're really, really, really good. And, you know, kind of it's clear that the step change that has happened since 2019 in generative models is not just about scale, it's about the transformer. So here's a theory, and this is, you know, kind of it's sort of my theory, but it's really heavily inspired by other people, in particular the work of James Whittington and Tim Berens, who have thought about this very carefully and probably in more detail than me. And if you think about what a transformer does, what it does is, you know, it takes information, you know, in, for example, in a sentence. And, you know, rather than receiving bits of information one by one, you know, what it does is it takes a chunk of information and it kind of buffers it. And what it learns are essentially, it essentially learns kind of a set of, it's called self-attention, but it essentially learns a set of like cross mappings between the information which is provided in the sequence and critically the positions in the sequence that information occupies, right? So you actually have a transformer, explicit representation of not only the contents, not only what is in the sentence or the image or whatever, but where it is, right? And this is very different from like an LSTM, because in an LSTM, time is there, but it's implicit, right? You just get the things bit by bit in time. You never learn to represent time itself. But the transformer actually affords the opportunity to represent position in the sequence, which if you're doing language going forward is time, right? Or space in an image. So what we have suddenly is
A transformer is not recurrent, like technically.
Well,
sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how you define recurrent, but it certainly does not have it does not maintain information through recurrent dynamics in that way. Right.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah.
No, that's absolutely fine. But anyway, but I think that the key element here, what I think is really important, is that you have explicit representations of contents and position, which we might call like structure, like where is everything in relation to everything else. So why is that important? Well, it's important because several people, including Tim and Tim Behrens and you know, a number of other people, you could probably credit Christian Dohler with some of these ideas. You know, and my group has very explicitly kind of made this claim as well, which is that it is the explicit representation of space in either a navigational sense or a kind of like peripersonal space, like, you know, the space that's around you, that explicit representation of space, which is really important for doing kind of complex forms of reasoning. And the argument goes something like the following, right? It's a little bit dense, but let me see if I can explain it. So I'll explain the theory that we articulated, which is not in terms of allocentric space or navigation, it's in terms of like reaching and grasping. So, you know, imagine you want to learn a very simple abstraction, like the concept of three, right? So three, that what does three mean? Three means that there are three objects in a scene, right? Okay, so we understand the concept of three. And what I mean by understand the concept of three is, what I mean is that if you saw a new scene that had three objects that you had never seen before, right? Completely new objects, you would still know there are three of them, right? So that means that your knowledge of three is independent of like the contents of the scene, right? Quite an explicit way, right? And so how do you actually learn that? It's really hard to think about how a neural network would learn that, because what neural networks learn, of course, are just statistical mappings between inputs and outputs, right? So, you know, kind of, it's hard to know if you take three new and completely different objects, they'd be out of distribution. So how would you ever learn that? Well, one argument is that what you do is you use the way in which you interact with the scene, so your action, as an input to the system. And by using that as an input to the system, so by explicitly representing how you can move, what you're doing is you're effectively constructing space. Like three objects only exist in three different locations, because you can move. What that means is that you can move to them and pick them up in different places, or move their eyes to them, and those are different locations that you've moved your eyes to. So the idea is that our knowledge of abstractions is formulated through the actions that we take in space, and it's by taking those actions in space that we learn an explicit representation of space. It means we actually have codes for space, which is, of course, primate, that's what's there in the dorsal stream, right? You know, we have these things called salience maps, which are intricately tied with, you know, kind of like space, the representations of where objects are in space. So that explicit representation of space, we argue, is really important for, like, kind of basically being able to reason about objects and being able to compose scenes from different combinations of objects in different spatial positions. And it's basically the primate brain factorizes what things are and where they are really, really explicitly. And so the argument is in the transformer that is the explicit representation of item and position that in the same way gives it the ability to do that amazing composition. So if you ask Deli for, you know, a blue tomato, you know, kind of on top of a pink banana, then, you know, it will generate an image that has that property, right? And, you know, as far as we understand, like, non-transformer-based architectures can't do that. And I believe that it's because the explicit representation of contents and position allows the network to kind of factorize what and where in the same way as the primate brain factorizes that information in the dorsal and ventral stream.
We're leaving out when in that account, right? So, you know, I'm thinking you were mentioning it when you take action. I thought you were also going to start talking about the timing of those actions. But yeah, in a sense, time and space could be considered analogous, right? So like reading, a transformer doesn't read the way that we read, but there is a timing. And so we have that order also.
Yeah, sorry, I sort of garbled my examples, right? So, you know, kind of, yeah, the transformer is easiest to illustrate by thinking about a sentence. But like, you know, kind the examples of composition are like most vivid when thinking about like image generation, right? And in image generation, position is space. In a sentence, position is time. In the primate brain, or at least in the human brain, you know, kind of, it seems more like when you really need to do like time over longer periods, like actual, you know, kind of clearly we represent the dynamics of action, or the, you know, we know that neural signals in the parietal cortex, in the dorsal stream, you know, build up in concert with the dynamics of action. We know that parietal cortex is really important for really short, like visual short-term memory or iconic memory, like short representation, you know, kind of in between two saccades, for example. But the sort of representation of time in a sentence in the in the human brain requires the prefrontal cortex, right? Which is why, of course, right, you know, kind of you have disordered action sequences and disordered language if you have lesions of the various parts of the prefrontal cortex. So I think that the time, it's a similar story, but in humans, you additionally need the prefrontal. But yeah, same principle.
Not to, you know, sometimes the way that I frame questions, I'm sort of, it's like I'm advocating some sort of AI versus neuro claim to foundational ideas, right? Because what I was going to ask you is, in, let's say, 10 years, if you're going to rewrite artificial natural intelligence, would you be able to include a story about how transformers map onto and or were inspired by neuroscience? And I ask
I don't think they were inspired by neuroscience. So I give you lots of examples of, you know, kind of where ideas kind of co-emerged. So you might say that maybe there's a co-emergence of these ideas in neuroscience and AI research, but, you know, kind of the transformer, you know, I do not think the authors of the transformer paper, you know, kind of read a neuroscience textbook and then were like, hey, this is a great idea. It's definitely not how it happened. Although, you know, kind of,
yeah.
No, sure. But maybe you could say the ideas are there in the ecosystem. But yeah, I mean, I think we will know more in 10 years' time. Hopefully before then, we will know more about that process of factorization and composition. It's already a sort of pretty significant research topic in computational neuroscience. And, you know, I'm fairly sure that, you know, we're going to learn more about that. And that's going to be really fruitful. And maybe the transformer is going to be, you know, yet another tool from AI research that, you know, gets co-opted and used to understand the brain. It wouldn't surprise me in the least.
All right. So I've taken us to the limit here. I really appreciate your time. I have one more question for you. And earlier you mentioned that you didn't want to call the book Natural General Intelligence. And yet the book is called Natural General Intelligence. So why is it called that? And did you have an alternative?
No, I just have a limited imagination. And eventually I gave up looking for other types.
Okay. Great answer. All right. Well, I really appreciate the book and our conversation today. Thanks for coming on again. And I guess I'll see you in a year's time or so, perhaps.
Well, I have to write another book then.
Get on it.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
I alone produce Brain Inspired. If you value this podcast, consider supporting it through Patreon to access full versions of all the episodes and to join our Discord community. Or if you want to learn more about the intersection of neuroscience and AI, consider signing up for my online course, Neuro AI, The Quest to Explain Intelligence. Go to braininspired.co to learn more. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. You're hearing music by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thank you for your support. See you next time.